Hi everyone, welcome to the webinar. This is Alexandra Alvarado. I'm the Director of Marketing and Education at the American Apartment Owners Association. We're so glad to have you listening in. Earlier today, we did try to get a live feed of this webinar broadcasting out to you guys. System was overwhelmed. We've never had more people join at one time. So here we are, recording this webinar for you. And thank you so much to Brad and Steve on the phone, our webinar speakers, who have so graciously given us more time to record this at a later day, a later time today. So thank you so much again, guys, for being so flexible with your time.
No problem.
Yeah. So just before we get started, I just want to mention a couple of things. This video is on YouTube. You can share it with anybody you want. We are the American Apartment Owners Association. We're the largest landlord association in the country with over 100,000 members, and we provide resources like these to landlords like you, property managers and brokers. We also have tenant screening and landlord forms as well. So I definitely encourage you to look into joining our association for free if you want to access more resources like this. On the call today, we have Brad Barth with Barth Calderon, LLP. He is an attorney for asset protection, and he has been with us before, a great speaker. I reached out to Brad because I knew that he would be most knowledgeable in what is going on with asset protection as coronavirus is unfolding. And likewise with Steve. Steve, we've had on as well. He handles a lot of landlord-tenant eviction law, and he is very also well-versed in what is going on with the changes and legislation that is developing as coronavirus is changing so many things for all of us. So I know all of you have so many questions. So we're going to get started with Brad's presentation first, and then kind of in between have Steve talk as well. And lastly, we'll finish off, if you guys don't mind, with just a few questions that people have written into us. I know we don't have people live to ask questions, but plenty of you have asked questions before the webinar. So we'll be ending it with a few of those that I've picked for us to review. And lastly, we are having a webinar next week as well. However, we have decided to pre-record it so that we don't have this issue again. So please send in your questions to us before next Wednesday, April 1st, so that we can have a Q&A with all of you in a recorded session. All right, with that being said, thank you again. Brad, take it away.
Great, thank you very much, Alexander. Appreciate it very much. And just as a matter of respecting everyone's time, and we are sharing this time between Steve and I, and there is just so much information that I'm sure both of us are going to be delivering to the audience. I made the decision to kind of go straight to the crux of the matter and address some of those very specific issues that have been coming into my office through either phone calls from my clients or through email. And so for those of you who have heard me previously, there's a full spectrum of things that we discuss in the areas of asset protection and estate planning, but I wanted to get straight to, I think, the two or three key topics, which I think are going to be most relevant to people who are online listening to us today. So just by a brief introduction, my name is Brad Barth. I'm a partner of the firm of Barth Calderon, and my areas of specialty are asset protection as well as estate planning. I also work a lot with real estate matters, business transactions, and in-house counsel and charitable matters. So I kind of have a very good grasp of the subject matter, and thankfully a majority of our clients, high net worth business owners, have some form of real estate as part of their overall portfolio, whether it's single family home, duplex, apartments, commercial buildings. So we deal with these landlord-tenant related issues on a regular basis. And now, in light of what's happening with COVID-19, I think it raises a whole nother set of issues. And Steve and I did have a chance to speak offline, and there were some things that I thought that are very important. I'm gonna try not to cross over too much on some of the areas, but I wanna make sure that we dive right into the subject matter. So when we normally speak with our clients, we're worried about liabilities to our landlords, our clients. The substantial majority of our clients are the landlords. They are the property owners. And when I typically do a presentation like this, when it comes to asset protection for real estate owners, we're normally worried about what we would call the pedestrian liabilities, the pedestrian risks. Remember the good old days of a slip and fall? or maybe a fire, you know, habitability issues, dog bite electrocutions, or maybe lead paint. But now we have a new character in the neighborhood, and this gentleman is called COVID-19. And this is raising, I think, an issue for all of us. And I think when it comes to business owners, the thing that bothers us and worries us the most, no virus or no virus, is cash flow. And there's no question that cash flow is going to be top of mind for all of us, not only in our own cash flow and our abilities to take care of our own obligations, but also what about our tenants, their cash flow? Because this is having obviously a trickle-down effect. I myself have already spoken to several of my clients in the normal course of business over the last couple of days. And I've asked them, I said, so what are you guys doing? What are you hearing from your tenants? And sure enough, just yesterday, I had a client of mine say that he already had two or three emails that day of clients wanting to have some type of a modification or temporary forbearance of paying rent. And as the fellow, so from the business owner's point of view, they're all worried about cash flow and how it's going to impact them. And so one thing that came up in conversation with Steve yesterday was insurance issues. And I thought about this because from an asset protection and liability point of view, we're always looking to insurance as our first line of defense. When our clients have a liability, we're trying to position their assets so that their assets are more difficult to get at. We never want to say that a client is going to be lawsuit proof. What we're hoping to say is that it becomes so difficult for them to be able to collect on the judgment that they do get, if they get it, that they're more likely to take a settlement based upon insurance or maybe insurance plus maybe some other dollars in an attempt towards reaching a fast and favorable settlement. But I think now more than ever, I think some of the insurance exclusions may wind up applying more so than in a normal course of business. We're talking about auto insurance policies and umbrella, commercial liability, but here we have property and casualty, very important, tenant insurance, landlord issues, professional malpractice, errors and omissions, directors and officers. These are insurance policies that we're always worried about. And I put an asterisk by the umbrella policy because I found over the years, and this hopefully I'm just reiterating this just for, you know, just for education purposes, but a lot of my clients seem to think that when they have an umbrella policy, that it somehow adds additional lines of protection when in fact that's not correct. So I just want to make sure that even though you may have a very large umbrella policy for your apartment building, $5 million or $10 million policy, well, if the underlying policy has an exclusion, then the umbrella isn't going to help you. Umbrella is just an additional amount of insurance coverage. It doesn't increase the scope of what is covered. So if we have an underlying exclusion in the policy, an umbrella policy isn't going to help. So you want to make sure we go back and take a look at what those exclusions are. And so I've been telling my clients, go back and take a look at this, because now there's a lot more activity happening on the premises that may not happen in the normal course of business. For example, right now, I'm actually running my law practice out of my home. I need to worry about, does my homeowner's policy have an exclusion for running a business out of my home or commercial purposes? What if I'm driving my car to go visit a client that I normally wouldn't be doing? Is my personal auto insurance policy going to have use of car for commercial purposes? I got to worry about these things because now things are a little bit different. So I think it's very important that as a first line of defense, we go back and take a look at our insurance policies to make sure that we have adequate coverages, not just the dollar amounts with these umbrellas, but are we covered themselves? So I think a very important takeaway here is that everyone should get on the phone with their insurance professional and speak with him or her and try to find out, under these unique circumstances, are there some type of endorsement that I should be aware of? Or am I covered if I do have a liability in my home while I'm working, or I do have an auto event while I'm doing something on behalf of the business that's not in the normal course and scope on the commercial side, but more on the personal side. So I think this is an important takeaway that we go back and take a look at this, because we as asset protection planners always look to the insurance to be there as our first line of defense. And if it's excluded, it's excluded. And that basically means that that 100% of whatever that liability is going to fall on you. So we want to make sure that we have some kind of secondary backup plan just in case the insurance is excluded for whatever reason, or there isn't sufficient coverages. And as I was mentioning with Steve on our conversation yesterday, there's a lot more activities happening now at home. You got kids that are, I got four kids. They're all here right now in school on the premises. You may have family members living together. So there may be a lot more tension and actions and maybe neighborhood frustrations, or when the dog would be carrying on next door, at least I get away for 8 hours, but now I don't. And maybe tempers fly. And what happens when we're in our common areas? And so these are some things I think that are relevant, because under these very stressful times, I think tempers may get the better of some of us. And there may be some liability issues there that maybe Steve can address in his half of the presentation. So I just think that an insurance discussion is very important. And the next thing is, I was doing some research this morning on behalf of for this call. And I was looking at, well, what about those individuals who may be getting calls about the need to defer mortgages? And I normally don't like reading slides, but I think there's enough here that I kind of snipped onto one that I think it's worth taking the time to actually reading it verbatim. So this comes from, this is dated March 23rd from fortune.com, and it's the need to defer your mortgage payments due to coronaviruses. Here's how, and it talks about three main areas. You got mortgage forbearance issues, mortgage modification options, and lender mortgage deferment plans. And I think what I have over here on the far right-hand side, I really can't say this better, so I do want to go ahead and take the time to read this. As the economic impacts of the coronavirus pandemic begin to hit home, many Americans are worried about how they'll make their mortgage payments, especially if they've been furloughed or laid off from their jobs. Mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac both have ordered lenders to be more flexible with borrowers, reducing or suspending payments up to 12 months. So we need to be prepared that if there's a deferrals up to 12 months, again, that goes back to my cash flow concern. Other mortgage lenders are likely to follow suit eventually, but if your lender hasn't set new policies yet and you're facing an immediate mortgage crisis, there are steps you can take. And this is kind of what Steve and I spoke about yesterday when we had a similar conversation. And this is kind of the advice. First off, and most important, don't just stop paying your mortgage. Reach out to your lender and work with them to create a payment plan that's as easy as making a phone call. It could be things like trying to find out, is there a way that we can just maybe make an interest payment only? Can I defer and let interest accrue? Can we kind of get it on the back end? Call your mortgage company, try to find out what options are available, whether you have a traditional loan or you have a commercial loan. Because if your cash flow starts drying up, you need to worry. It's a worry for all of us. And we should be having conversations with our lenders, because I'm sure like you, just like myself and you, we're all worried about our credit worthiness. We're all investors. We want to make sure that we have the ability to acquire lending again in the future. And I'm sure we want to make sure that our credit rating stays very, very sharp. And hopefully we're going to be able to work with our lenders if we feel that we're going to be in a cash flow pinch. And now some of the actual issues, I think, as far as landlord personal liability, this is kind of crossing over to some of the more traditional asset protection, limited liability things that I deal with, some things that are specific to protecting yourself from tenant lawsuit. And the main tool that we use, of course, is an LLC. But before I jump into a legal tool of protection, let's just make sure that we have an understanding of what these legal entities do for us, the landlord, simply from a landlord-tenant liability perspective. I'm still amazed, even with all the information that's out there on the internet and radio broadcasts and all the education seminars that are available, people are still renting property in their individual names. Bob and Mary Smith, husband and wife, are just renting property to an apartment building or to individuals in their own name. And that, in my opinion, is financial suicide. They say, well, I've never really had a problem. And I always add on the word yet. it's never really a matter of if, it's always a matter of when. Every state has different laws when it comes to landlord-tenant liability issues, but they're almost universally very tenant-friendly. And so when you have a landlord-tenant issue, the things that tenants can sue landlords for are unbelievable as far as the creativity. Electrocutions, lead paint, there's mold, there's fires, there's dog bites, there's neighbors, there's insufficient lighting, insufficient security. There's things that are just unbelievable as far as the liabilities that are being imposed onto our landlords. And again, if those insurances aren't available for us, we now need to either find some way to limit our liability or to find some way to contain that liability. And so the first thing that we use, again, always is the insurance as a way of mitigation. But if the insurance, for whatever reason, fails, we need to have a fallback plan. And this is where legal entities come into play. And the legal entity of choice is going to be an LLC or a limited liability company. And the very common structure that we're looking at here for clients that have LLCs is kind of represented by this diagram I have on the slide here. You have a manager over here, which typically is the client. They're the ones running the day in and day out operations. Well, the client themselves are also the members or the owners, and they have a piece of property or two or three or four or five or six inside the LLC. And the amount of property that goes inside an LLC is always something to be concerned about, because some properties have greater risk profiles than others. I always ask, is it a single family home behind a gated community? Is it a duplex? Is it a threeplex? Is it a fourplex? Is it a condo? Is it a commercial building? Is it an apartment building? Is it in a low socioeconomic demographic? Is it in a high socioeconomic demographic? Because all these things create a risk profile of the property. And the more properties you stick into one LLC, the multiple of risk profile increases geometrically by the number of properties inside the entity, because each property may have a certain number of human beings on there, a certain amount of souls and activities. You're going to have a traditional family, a husband, a wife, a couple of kids, a dog. Okay, that's four or five people located on one entity. Okay, well, they may have a friend or two over, and then you put inside the same entity a fourplex. And now you got four units and at least two people, that's eight souls. And now they may have a kid or two. Next thing you know, you got 16 souls over here and five souls over here. And next thing you know, you got whatever the math winds up, 22 entities, 22, 23 active people, all of which may be a source of liability. So sometimes you look at it and say, well, it may be worth diversifying the entity by separating out the property into their own separate holding company. And so here, when we have a lot of activity happening, especially under these current circumstances, we want to find out whether or not we can diversify the holdings. And we take a look at the risk profile of the companies. I'm sorry, of the properties. Because when you're looking at one, if you have a liability here on property number one, you don't sue property number one. You sue the owner of property number one. In this case, it's the LLC. And when you sue the LLC, everything inside that LLC is at risk. Well, what else is inside this LLC? Besides property one, we also have property number two. And because it's inside property number two, we now have had a cross-contamination. In other words, property number two is now adversely affected because of the activities on the land in property number one. And so if you see this as potential risks, again, it could be socioeconomics, it could be the amount of people on there. It could just be the amount of equity inside the properties. All kinds of different factors go in to making a decision as to how to limit the exposure within the entity. Now here, you see you yourself as the landlord, yes, you get personal protection. That's the limited liability component of an LLC. You lost all of your investment because they gobbled up all the assets inside, but you're going to walk away hopefully without any personal liability. So an alternative to this now is to use what I call a multi-entity structuring strategy. In other words, I have it in red here, segregate individual assets into individual entities. So here we have the exact same scenario We diversified. We identified a problem, LLC number one, a problem property. And we also identified one of our preferred properties. Maybe this is the commercial building that's worth $2 million. And maybe this is the condo that has the college kids on it that's leveraged out and has no value in it. So if you have the same liability in property number one, now you've limited in space and scope the actual liability of as a result of that. You yourself are protected, as you can see by the down arrow. And guess what? Your other property is also protected because it's not inside the same entity. The defendant here is LLC one, not LLC two. And consequently, you're able to diversify and thereby limit the liability and protect your overall investment. So I want to share this with you because besides what's happening with COVID-19 and the other, this is just good best practices inside the area of landlord, tenant, or real estate investment. You want to diversify the actual investments and diversify what's at risk. But LLCs also provide us another level of protection, and this is also going to be important. Now we have the exact same LLC 1, LLC 2, but now we're not worried so much about a tenant activity. Now we're worried about our own personal creditors. This can go back to our cash flow issues. Well, all of a sudden now, because of lack of cash flow, the bank's looking to you. You're having a problem. It's your creditor. And the creditor is not going to be looking to your assets to satisfy whatever obligations that are outstanding. Nothing to do with the activities on the land, but now you are the offending party. You are the problem. You are the weak link here. And thankfully, LLCs set up in proper jurisdictions, not all states are created equally, set up in proper jurisdictions will also provide a level of a liability shield as well. So therefore, the banks will have a very difficult time, or any creditor for that matter, will have a very difficult time in penetrating into these LLCs to grab and foreclose on the assets. Even if we do wind up having some type of stay on foreclosures, at some point in time, those stays are going to be removed. And if you have any pending liabilities that result from all of this, you want to make sure that your assets are protected. So LLCs, as you can see through these couple of examples, are giving us, as you can see in quotations here, dual protection. They're protecting us from what's happening internally, that's the personal liability, and they're also protecting our assets from our personal creditors as well. So it's very important tools. And like I said, we use these as tools in different jurisdictions. Like here I have an example of Apartment Holdings LLC set up in Delaware, authorized in California because this apartment is inside California. Oh, here we have Townhouse Holdings LLC, Nevada, authorized in California because the townhouse is located in California. We always have to have the entities registered where the property resides and where the entity is doing business. But we have 50 different states, and we can choose of 50 different laws on what we want to govern our enterprises. And so here we look to the most favorable states for our clients to try to maximize their asset protection and their limited liability. In this case, we're using Delaware and or we're using Nevada for various reasons. And also, I want to make sure, since we're talking about real estate, I want to talk about residences also. And what I found with residences and or any properties, I kind of like this graphic a lot because when someone sues you for a piece of property, they're not so much interested in taking the property itself. What they're really interested in is getting the value that that property represents. That's a very important thing. So the first thing we want to take a look at is, well, how much of that property's value by law are you allowed to keep? And every state differs on what's called its homestead exemptions. And one of the advantages of being a national speaker in the area of asset protection is that as I go from state to state, I get to look up what is the homestead exemption in this particular state. And some states are fantastic, right? You have Florida, an unlimited exemption, or Texas, anything you can build on 2 acres of land, and Nevada. And then you get over to my area, California, where the exemption actually is very low relative to the property values. And then you walk over to areas over like on the East Coast and you have very low exemptions, but you have something else to kind of offset that. And what a homestead exemption is, it's the amount of equity in your property that you are allowed to keep notwithstanding filing for bankruptcy or losing assets as a result of a creditor's claim. It's the amount that the creditor needs to give back to you as a result of a foreclosure that you get to keep the remainder of the assets or equities used to pay off the creditors. It's called a homestead exemption. And I strongly recommend everyone that's listening to this recording to go on to do a very simple Google search. It's all part of your state statutes, and type in your state and type in homestead exemption and take a good look to see what those exemption amounts are. Because it's very important. It only applies also typically to your primary residence. It's not like it's across the board all the assets. It typically only applies to your primary residence. Some states, not in California, but some states, about half the states in the country, have something called tenancy by the entirety. This also is very important. And I kind of noticed that when I have a state that has a very low homestead exemption, like $5,000 or $15,000 or $30,000, very low. I mean, $30,000 in equity, I mean, that's nothing. It's typically offset with something called a tenancy by the entirety exemption. I'm not going to spend the time in going into detail about it, but it's a very powerful asset protection tool for married couples in these states. So another good Google search to do is, hey, is my state a tenancy by the entirety state? And if so, it's something to look into and something to explore. Because here again, it's also a very powerful tool to help protect equity in your assets should you have some kind of liability issue and you do have tenancy by the entirety. There's not a lot of fancy schmancy stuff we have to do with it. We can just take advantage of what the state law is providing for us. And one of the other things that we deal with when it comes to residences, and this is also dealing with residences, and it also applies in certain cases with rental properties as well, is it falls back on another tenet of asset protection, is privacy. You want to try to go, as I would say, incognito as much as legally possible. And one of the most difficult things about owning real estate is that everyone, it's all recorded. It's the most public of all public records is who owns the property. You can put in someone's name in a public record search, all the properties show up, you then Zillow that and you find out what the value is. Typically, it even lists in the chain of title how much you refinanced or bought the property for, and you can do some quick math to try to figure out how much equity does somebody have in their property portfolio. So one thing that we try to do is, well, can we get the client's identity off the public records? And the answer is yes, you can. You can use a thing called a blind trust. And through the use of a blind trust, we can get your name off of public records. Therefore, when someone is doing a public record search to find out who owns your property, your name doesn't show up. We do it a lot for celebrity clients here in California, sports figures. I do it a lot for landlords, people who own properties. They just don't want tenants knocking on their front door at 3 o'clock in the morning, say, hey guy, when are you gonna fix my toilet? Right? You want some level of privacy. And I got all kinds of weird stories I can share with you about how people are defaming people or coercing or bullying them into doing things simply because they're using public records to their disadvantage. And so here we have a tool. It's the combination of a blind trust coupled with a blind LLC. And using the two of these tools together, we are able to have the property go incognito and yet still give you very powerful asset protection. And this applies in the area of commercial properties. It also applies in residentials. Because for those properties that are residential, we want to maintain its residential status for all the tax reasons. There's a big difference in tax world between residential property and investment property. So you want to make sure that we're able to maintain those tax advantages as a resident, and this type of blind trust arrangement solves that as well. And there's one last thing I want to just talk about before I hand it over to Steve here is, this is one of the other areas where there's a big crossover, and I want to make sure we highlight this, especially now in what's called in estate planning land. And this deals with the use of powers of attorney for both healthcare and property management. So my two key areas of practice that I do is asset protection planning, as I mentioned, for business owners and high net worth individuals. And the other area is asset protection and business succession planning. And I have drafted over the last 20, 22 years, thousands of estate plans. I've read an equal number of them. And I've sat across the table with many clients And when they come to me for estate planning, they always have pretty much two worries on their head. One, I want to avoid probate. Okay, great. Two, who gets my stuff when I pass away, right? So the conversation always, they come in, revolves around avoiding probate and basically who gets my stuff when I die. And I always stop for a moment and say, listen, you need to be concerned not about the postmortem stuff, because there's a very important part of estate planning that deals with you during your lifetime. It affects you. There are documents where you are the principal beneficiary during your lifetime. And I give my clients another metric to measure this by. If somebody passes away, we're able to kind of muster up the assets, get an inventory and appraisal and pay off the debts and set up the trust for your kids or make distributions for the beneficiaries, let's say 18 months. But God forbid you have a car accident. God forbid you get sick. Now you're operating under the powers of attorney for healthcare or property management. Someone's making decisions for you. And it's not just 18 months. It could last 18 years. And as I mentioned to Steve yesterday, I said, it took a virus to make this the biggest issue, because that's what everyone is worried about right now. You're walking in the hospitals, the first question they're asking you, do you have an advanced healthcare directive? Who makes medical decisions if you can't do it for yourself? How do you feel? What type of quality of long-term care facility would you be in if necessary, so you have a degree of dignity? How do you feel about anatomical gifting, about organ donation? If you have some kind of dot on the driver's license, you're not giving your agent any instructions on how to make those gifts, right? It's not just anything and everything and research and teaching cadavers. Well, what if you wanted it limited to non-institutional beneficiaries, only if I directly help another human being? Well, let's say so. What if you have religious issues that are very important on how your body is handled in a post-mortem fashion? Let's make sure we say so. We're trying to give our agents as much information as possible so they can make proper and informed decisions on our behalf. And also, in light of what's happening, again, just highlighting the circumstances, that we always want to have those provisions, which we refer to as the natural death acts, or living wills, not last wills, living wills. In other words, the pull the plug provisions. If you're in that type of state where you're incapacitated, you're in a persistent vegetative state, and but for the human intervention, your body would just, all you're doing is artificially prolonging the moment of your passing. A lot of my clients are like, well, I don't really want to put my family under that emotional stress, and certainly not the financial stress, but let me go, pull the plug, but I still want enough care for my medical, for comfort and to alleviate pain. Here again, let's say so. That stuff needs to be in writing. We need what's called clear and convincing evidence to prevent those Terry Schiavo cases of the world. And another very important point, I'm doing this right now, even for my own parents, what happens under the durable power of attorney for property management? So now my mom and dad, you know, they're in their early 70s, and they are totally willing, actually, I would say able to go to the store and to do the banking and get and take care of business. But guess what? They're willing but unable. They're not going out of their house. They are in that high risk. So I'm helping them with all the business operations, and I did banking, I'm doing grocery shopping, I'm helping my parents out, but and if I needed to sign any documentation, I can do it on their behalf as their agent under the power of attorney for property management. If under these circumstances, if someone becomes incapacitated, who has the ability to get a loan under these favorable rates? Who has the ability to sign them into medical facilities? Who collects the government benefits that may be coming down here pretty shortly? Who gets access to the bank account or the safety deposit box? Somebody has to have the ability to manage finances if you are otherwise unable or unwilling. And again, it doesn't have to be true incapacity. I'm just not leaving the house because I walk out, I'm afraid I'm going to get some kind of virus. So again, here, very, very practical consideration. But then also, take a look what's happening with the law firm. Here, in my circumstances, my mom is perfectly able to take care of all of my father's stuff. But what about the law firm? My mom is not the best person to take care of things on behalf of the law firm. I'm the best person as the other partner in the firm. So here we have clients that have a general power for everything, but my business partner or my CFO or my COO, they're the best person for the business. So we can make a limited power of attorney for business management and the general power of attorney for everything else, which may be the spouse. Here again, a very important document that I think is coming into play now more than ever, because this is not a mass issue of people becoming incapacitated. This is a mass issue where people cannot function at the same level that they functioning just 2 or 3 weeks ago. Okay, so I want to make sure that this was a major crossover for all of our clients on the ability to do so. And Paul told me that if I didn't put this slide on the screen, he would absolutely kill me. So let's make sure that I went ahead and put this on here. So both for myself as well as for Steve, if you want to get a hold of us for any kind of free assessments or complimentary consultations, text the word YES, YESBC, YESBC to 474747. Again, for a free assessment, text YESBC to 474747, and you'll get on either my calendar or on Steve's calendar as kind of a follow-up. So I know I spoke very, very quickly. I wanted to make sure that I got through, I think, the main highlights, which I think you as a business owner, you as a property owner are concerned with. And now with that, I want to hand it over to Steve so he can tell you more about the specific landlord-tenant issues that you're going to be dealing with. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Brad. And some very excellent information there with regard to limiting your liability. And I really liked how you explained how you can limit it for, you know, liability as against your tenants, as claims by your tenants, as well as from outside creditors. You know, both are so important right now, particularly in the current sort of state of emergency environment. So I'm going to share my screen here. Just going to take a moment. Let me see if I can pull this up and get this going. Just 1 second here. And okay, so my name is Steve Williams, and I've been doing real estate and landlord-tenant law now for a little over 20 years. And I just sort of want to elaborate and sort of continue on what Brad was saying. And that's the importance, it's, you know, an asset protection, a liability protection, is the insurance aspect. And I can't really underscore enough the importance of having the proper insurance in place, as Brad mentioned. And so typically when someone comes to my office and asks, you know, hey, I need your assistance with dealing with a tenant, we need to recover possession. The first thing I do before I send out any correspondence or any sort of eviction notice to the tenant, I say, let me see your insurance policy. I want to make sure you have the appropriate coverage in place. And typically what I'm looking for is most insurance policies will include bodily injury and property damage, which is great. You need that. But I also look specifically for what's known as personal injury. So I want to see personal injury in that policy. So those three things, bodily injury, property damage, personal injury, are some of the things that I specifically look for. As well as in California, you can really sue anyone for anything. You can have all the asset protection in place. It's not going to prevent someone from running down to the courthouse and filing a lawsuit. And by having the proper insurance in place, you will, as the first line of defense, hopefully be able to get your insurance company to pony up on the cost for the defense of that lawsuit, and hopefully the ultimate resolution of that lawsuit as well. But because it's so easy and because the liability is so high, I typically want to see also $1 million liability coverage. And sort of to illustrate or put into an example here in the current situation, you know, many of you probably saw in the news the partiers, the spring breakers in Florida out on the beach, you know, having a good time and just, you know, flaunting the current stay away and stay home orders that were in place. And, you know, you could have a similar situation with a tenant. Maybe you have a large multi-unit building and you have a tenant who just doesn't care. Maybe they're throwing a coronavirus party, inviting all their young friends over who feel, you know, who are fearless and feel, you know, indestructible. And then suddenly, you know, they're putting other lives in that property in danger. And guess what? Guess who's going to get sued should someone, God forbid, become ill, should someone end up, you know, becoming seriously ill, maybe even passing away as a result? It's going to be the property owner. It's most likely not going to be that tenant who's the source of the problem. But it's most likely going to be the property owner, that the owner, you know, either knew or should have done something about this or to prevent it. Regardless, it's going to be the property owner who gets sued. So again, the importance of the asset protection with insurance and maybe creating specific entities, as Brad talked about, to help shield against that potential liability is crucial. And it kind of underscored by the current events and what's going on right now throughout the world, basically. So let's talk a little bit about some of the laws. So right now, as you're aware, there's a state of emergency, and that's throughout the entire country. Donald Trump declared a national emergency, as well as 48 states. The last I looked was 48 states had also declared states of emergency. And these are important, you know, not just for government resources, but also from these emergencies come about certain laws that may impact property owners. And I'll talk about that in a moment here. In addition to the state of emergency orders, there's also numerous states who've said, you know what, stay home, don't leave. In fact, it's a crime if you leave. You can only leave for certain you know, important essential activities you know, that are important to the infrastructure of the community. And here, it looks like there's about 15 states here, including the state I'm in, which is California, which is basically saying, you know what, stay home, don't go anywhere. So that's important. There's laws that are in place and potential. I know some of my, some of the jurisdictions around here are, actually beginning to enforce these with criminal, you know, potentially pursuing, you know, criminal liability against individuals who are violating the stay home orders. And also you're endangering other people by not staying home and heeding the applicable laws. So the resulting state laws, like I mentioned, from some of these emergency orders come some resulting state laws. And I'm speaking for California, and I'm sure other states have similar laws. But for instance, in California, when a state of emergency is declared, that immediately kicks in a criminal code, which says no price gouging. And this is important for property owners because, as you can see on the slide here, one, you cannot give rent increases during the state of emergency that exceed 10%. So you can't gouge tenants by giving them unlawful or excessive rent increases. But more importantly, or as importantly also, no evictions and then re-renting a unit at an amount that even exceeds the displaced tenant. So if your tenant was paying $2,000 a month during this emergency period, you end up terminating that tenancy and then renting to someone else for more than $2,000 a month. In California, that's a crime. It's a violation of the anti-gouging laws. So there are most likely similar type laws in place in your communities or in your states as well. It will vary, but I'm just giving you a broad overview here as to some of the implications of these states of emergency laws. Now, in addition to state, I talked about national orders, then there's state emergency orders and laws in place. There's also local laws. So many cities, like I practice in the Bay Area, as you can see from my background here, the Golden Gate Bridge. Certain cities have enacted additional laws to protect tenants, basically to maintain the status quo for tenants during this emergency period. For instance, in San Francisco, there is a moratorium basically on non-payment rent evictions. You can't evict a tenant right now in San Francisco for not paying if that non-payment was due to the coronavirus. It's very broad, whether it's the person actually became sick or lost their job or any impact. Maybe they can't leave their house because of the stay-home orders. Any impact that is limiting their ability to pay rent, they may very well get a reprieve, at least temporarily, from the obligation to do so. This doesn't mean this is a waiver of the rent altogether, at least not yet. I have heard some advocates here lobbying for just that. I have not yet seen that in any of the local jurisdictions whose laws I've looked into, where it's a straight waiver of the obligation to pay rent, period. No, it's a deferment right now, at least in San Francisco. I know Los Angeles, I believe Hayward, there are some other counties and cities around California as well have similar type of laws in place, but it defers the rent for a period of time until the emergency orders are lifted. And then some jurisdictions even have long-term repayment plans. Like for instance, in San Francisco, and I believe Los Angeles is the same, even after, let's say the emergency laws are in effect until the end of May of this year, and then beginning June 1st, maybe the obligation to pay rent kicks back in again. Well, the rent during March, April, and May may be deferred and repaid over a period of time. In San Francisco, it's 6 months. So the tenant would then have a six-month period to repay that deferred rent. So again, it's all very fluid right now. And I'm speaking as to what I've seen as of today. And different laws are changing, you know, different things are being enacted, and, you know, different jurisdictions have different things in place right now. And what is today could be different tomorrow. And what is today through the end of April could be extended to the end of June tomorrow, or at some point in the near future. So, you know, try to stay attuned as to what the local laws are in your area, as well as the state laws. So we talked about sort of what the federal government has done, what some states have done, as well as what local jurisdictions can and have done. Well, guess what? The courts themselves are basically, for all intents and purposes, shut down. So even in most jurisdictions, in order to enforce any lease violation or to litigate any tenant dispute, you got to go to the courts. You can't evict someone, at least not in California and in most states. You can't evict someone without going to court and getting a judgment or an order. Well, the courts are shut down, which for most purposes, for most general civil litigation, there are some exceptions for things like temporary restraining orders and things like that. But for general civil litigation and evictions, you may be able to file something, but you're not going to get a court date. You're not going to get any responses from the other side during any court shutdowns. And the times vary for the shutdowns. Like over in Marin, the last I read, it was through the end of March. I think that's going to be extended much longer than that. San Francisco and Alameda County, which is where Oakland is and Berkeley is I believe until April 7th, the courts are essentially shut down. Again, I think that's most likely going to be extended. So we're looking probably for the long haul, where even if you had a dispute, and even if the laws allowed you to proceed with an eviction, you just might not be able to because of the inability of the courts to actually, you know, entertain those actions. And I just heard just this morning, I believe it was, from the California Supreme Court that all jury trials throughout the entire state of California are now delayed 60 days. And guess what? Any eviction lawsuit, any landlord-tenant litigation, at least in California, is entitled to a jury trial unless it's at the small claims court level. And I believe that a lot of states are similar. So right now, it's just it's a time where there may not be a lot you can do because of certain state and local restrictions, as well as just the court's capacity to entertain any sort of a litigation or dispute right now. Now, we talked earlier, you know, I mentioned that there's some restrictions in place about failure to pay rent. Well, what can a landlord do at this point? And I'm getting those questions from clients left and right over this last week and a half. You know, what do I do when this happens? Or it's already happening. I've already heard from my tenant who's lost their job. For the most part, it appears that, you know, the tenants in those situations are fairly sincere about it. I suppose there probably will be some tenants taking advantage, but you need to look to your local laws. Like, for instance, in San Francisco, the tenant's required to provide some sort of demonstrative proof that they're unable to pay, something that is objectively shows that they can't afford to pay the rent at this point due to the coronavirus. And then at that point, then that triggers the landlord's obligation to work with the tenant. So what I'm at least telling my clients right now is, you know, try to be sympathetic and try to work with the tenant and get, you know, if the tenant can offers to pay half, get what you can. You know, bird in the hand is worth, you know, more than nothing. Don't say it's all or nothing. Try to get something. So if they can pay half, then, you know, again, depending on the current laws in your jurisdiction, you may be compelled to defer the unpaid balance to a later date. So, you know, again, try to be sympathetic, try to work with the tenant, try to get something you can, let the tenant know that you're willing to work with the tenant. And if they can afford to pay anything, you know, try to get that. And that, unfortunately, is really all you can do. And Brad did say some good information, because the other question I'm getting is, well, how am I going to pay my mortgage? You know, how am I going to be able to afford my business? And Brad gave, you know, some good information there with some resources as to who to reach out to. And I know also just today there was mentioned also sort of the recovery plan, the infusion of money that's going to be out there allocated for certain things. And I know a portion of that money is earmarked for small businesses. So perhaps there will be some money there as well for those who are in the rental business, who are taking a hit because their tenants can't afford to pay rent. But right now you're going to have to work with your tenants. The other big question I get is, you know, the first one is, you know, my tenants aren't paying rent, or they're not going to pay rent, or I'm concerned about that. The other is, and we talked about this just a moment ago, is a tenant who is just flouting the rules, just endangering other people in the in a building or in the neighborhood, creating a nuisance in essence. Well, nuisance is a ground for eviction, even in rent control jurisdictions. If a tenant's creating a nuisance, that's a basis for eviction. And that right now is a nuisance eviction is not one of the protected types of evictions in the jurisdictions I've seen, where a landlord can still proceed against a tenant for sort of a tenant's conduct type of evictions, like a nuisance or illegal activities. So if it's given rise to that, if the tenant's conduct has given rise to that, like I suggested earlier, throwing, you know, and I just read about this today, someone threw a young 20-something individual threw a coronavirus party. They had their friends over. If things like that are going on and endangering other people, then you may be able to take steps at this point, and probably should take steps to protect the neighbors and the other tenants in the building from potential liability. And like I said, you can still proceed with that type of eviction with any sort of notice or warning. But again, the problem is the court's capacity. You may not actually get to litigate it, but at least at this point, you can put the tenant on notice and do everything that you can to get the tenant to stop doing that and possibly even evict the tenant. But certainly at a minimum, I believe that, taking steps and being proactive as a landlord at this point to, one, work with your tenants who may not be able to pay the rent, but two, to also ensure the safety of the other tenants. In fact, at least in California, and again, in most states, a landlord has a duty or an obligation that's inherent in all contracts to actually provide quiet enjoyment to their tenants. And so part of that would be, you know, ensuring that they're their safety is not jeopardized by other tenants, and to potentially take steps to take action or to prevent that. And also, you can always refer any tenant who is complaining to you about this or concerned about this, about maybe one of their neighbors, to, well, look, if they're out violating these local orders, these stay home orders, or they're out, touching things in the common areas or doing things they probably shouldn't be doing, well, maybe you can call the authorities. I hear about situations where neighbors hear their other neighbors coughing and calling the police for something like that. Don't waste, put the police resources on things like that. But if you have a legitimate concern about someone potentially creating an endangerment to others in common areas of the building, then not only notifying the landlord and let the landlord do what they can to address it, but also potentially notify the authorities. Finally, the last thing I want to talk about, and it's not here in the slide here, but Brad and I talked a little bit about this yesterday. It's this term or phrase, what's known as force majeure, which is a party to a contract may be able to get out of a contract as a result of some act of God. And I've seen this now on a couple of occasions. I've not seen it in the residential context, although I could foresee it, where a residential tenant wants to get out of a lease because of the coronavirus. Usually it's the exact opposite. They want to stay in the lease. They just want to defer the rent. But it has come up in a couple of different contexts that, well, hey, a tenant could try to back out of a lease. Maybe they just signed a lease and they're a month into it and they want to move back home with mom and dad or something like that. So they use this act of God, which under state laws as well as contract laws, a party to a contract can get out of a contract as a result of an act of God. The traditional example of an act of God might be like an earthquake. That's the prime example that I see here in San Francisco in the Bay Area is an earthquake could certainly frustrate the ability to perform a contract. But generally, it really has to result in a sort of an impossibility or an extreme impracticability to perform the contract. And in my initial analysis, it doesn't appear to me, at least, this coronavirus and losing one's job is a basis to void a contract under these force majeure laws. But as I mentioned to Brad yesterday, you're going to get a lot of creative lawyering out of this. And who knows, what the laws will, how they'll come about and how they'll be interpreted going down the line. But it is certainly just something to think about. But like I said, initially, it just doesn't seem to me that someone losing a job as a result of the coronavirus is akin to an act of God creating an impossibility to perform a contract. But I just wanted to mention that and let you know that may be something that you encounter at some point, and you'll definitely want to consult with a lawyer about that and about these other issues as well, and just stay up to date and in tune with what the laws are in your state and in your local community. With that said, that's pretty much all I wanted to hit at this point. If Alexandra, you had any questions that you wanted to pass along at this point, I'm happy to see if I can answer them for you.
Yes, thank you so much. You both did a fantastic job covering most of the questions that people had. A lot of them that came in were very similar questions. What do we do when they stop paying rent? How do we create a deferral plan? And I think that you've answered that. It really is something that is going to be local and is developing on a regular basis. But there are a few points that I did see and I wanted to have you guys address. One is for maintenance and vendors coming to the property. I had several people, including Edna, asking here if they can have maintenance people and vendors come to the property, that tenants have fears now of people coming, strangers coming to fix things. What can they do to address that? Is there any liability with allowing maintenance staff to work on the property?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, even in areas where there's the stay home order or the shelter in place orders. There are exceptions for essential business and essential sort of, you know, things that are required to keep the economy running in that area. And one of those, at least in California, is, you know, real estate and providing housing. So an exception would be, and this is, again, this is inherent in all leases, whether it's in the contract or not, is a landlord has an obligation to provide a tenant with a habitable premises. Mm-hmm. So I get this question, I've had it a few times this week. Here's been my general response. If it's something small that isn't really affecting the livability of the tenant, you know, for instance, you know, there's the gas heater is just shut down and they have no hot water, things like that. Those, I believe, are more crucial, and that the owner or the property manager should arrange to get someone out there to address that. Now, something smaller, if it's just something small that can be, you know, be lived with by the tenant, I've told the client to put the ball in the tenant's court. I just had one where a client was looking to replace a dishwasher. And I told, you know, look, that's not something that's essential to the livability of the unit. Why don't you put it on the tenant? Look, under the circumstances, we prefer to wait until the, you know, until things have passed. It's a little safer in light of the stay home and shelter in place orders. So we'd prefer to defer that, you know, repair, that installation at this point. You know, what do you want us to do? And sure enough, the tenant in that case said it can wait. And I think that'll probably by and large be what most tenants do. So I think probably here it's going to be best to try and work with the tenant to the as best you can. And with regard to liability, again, you know, you just want to refer everyone, you know, your vendors and your tenants to, you know, to you know, employ, you know, proper protocols, you know, staying away from each other, you know, certainly wiping down areas, and, you know, maybe wearing gloves and things like that, and masks or whatever you possibly can do for those situations where a vendor absolutely does need to get in and address an issue.
I think I'll add on one comment, and Steve, if you wouldn't mind, can you unshare your screen? There was one request from one of the.
Yep, sorry about that.
No problem. And I think there's the proverbial. Let's see if we can. I think there's a unshare, stop sharing. I think the option is.
Looking for it. Let's see.
It's going to be a red button, I think, on the little control panel.
And just a second here. Why don't you just go ahead?
Okay. So I think one of the areas that, and Steve, you mentioned it, it's basically that the landlord has a duty to make sure that the premises is habitable and also in a reasonably safe condition for what are called licensees and invitees, that are people that are on the property. But I think the key word in this analysis is going to be reasonable. There's called the reasonable person test. And that reasonable person test is always looked at in light of the totality of the facts and circumstances. And so what may have been reasonable from a habitability, for example, Steve said, my dishwasher isn't working. Maybe a month ago, maybe that was part of the use and enjoyment of the property, but maybe now that may not be reasonable under the circumstances to bring in a maintenance worker, exposing themselves or you to them. So I think that these landlord liability issues and these invitees and licensees onto the property need to always be looked through the glasses of what's called the reasonable person test. Okay.
And I'm sorry, I'm a neophyte here with this particular.
Brad, if you want to share your screen with that slide of the text phone number.
I cannot start while others are sharing.
Okay. Yeah. No worries. I'll keep going with the questions. I have just a few more.
Okay.
So the next one is sort of similar. I have a question from Latasha, but also from other people along the lines of, if we have a new tenant that's going to be moving in, do I need them to sign anything verifying that they don't have coronavirus or that they haven't been outside of the country what can I do to protect other tenants if I need to also be filling vacancies at this time?
Yeah, so my thought there is that you probably should not get into any sort of medical request certain medical information. So I think that would probably be private to specifically ask that particular question. Instead, it could be, educating that person that they need to take, proper protocols that are in place, like the social distancing and things like that, with regard to, their, use and occupancy of the unit in the common areas. But I would not recommend, requesting any specific medical information or personal information.
Okay. So the next question as well, I think, Steve, you sort of hit on this about evicting for non-payment of rent, but what about evicting if the home has been put up for sale? I have two people, Rita and Jamalay, both have their homes up for sale. Escrow will not close until the tenant moves out. Tenants don't want to move anymore because of the situation. So is there anything you can do in that case? And then also from Karen as well, has a tenant whose lease ended and now they don't want to leave. Yeah. Likewise, somebody else, vandalism, they don't want to leave. Now, I think vandalism might fall under that criminal category, but certainly the sale of the home and the termination of a lease, what do you suggest in those situations?
Yeah, so first, again, your state, may have a just cause requirement for eviction, like California, where the sale of a property is not a just cause to actually terminate a tenancy. However, most states do not have those strict laws, but the emergency, laws that were passed in local jurisdictions do have, some of them do have some restrictions on elective evictions. So a situation where a landlord is attempting to electively evict, so it's not non-payment of rent and it's not based on tenant default, but instead electing to evict, first check your local laws to see, that are in place as a result of the emergency. Check to see if there's any restriction on those types of evictions. If so, you may have to wait. If not, then you can go ahead and proceed with the termination. But again, then you may get into a backlogged court system and not have any real ability to litigate that and actually get a judgment to get them out. So again, check the local laws, but notwithstanding any restrictions, you can proceed with the eviction as you normally would. Now, you may want to give some sort of concessions at this point, maybe a little more time based on the circumstances. Maybe escrow gets pushed out until a reasonable time after the emergency orders are lifted and it's safe to go back out again. But absent that, you can go ahead and proceed with the eviction as planned.
Okay. Next question here, and I think this will probably be our last for now. The question comes from David, Marsha, and a couple of others, basically asking about whether or not they should provide their tenants with some sort of contract or agreement regarding the deferral of rent. If they can choose, what kind of proof would be acceptable or require proof? Now, these are questions coming from people who are in states that currently don't have a local law in place that requires this. So okay. They're really doing this to help their tenants out, but they want to do it in a way where they're not taken advantage of, mm-hmm. is what I understand.
Got it. So it just so happens I'm working on a forbearance agreement right now, sort of in the preparing stages, the drafting stages. But yeah, if you're in a jurisdiction that doesn't require you to postpone or defer any rent payment, then you're at an advantage there that you can sort of dictate whether you're going to, one, and two, what the tenant may need to provide you. Now, remember, if they're providing you with confidential medical information, you have to ensure that will remain confidential. But if you're just requesting, you know, hey, look, I just need to see information that your income has dropped or maybe you've lost your job. You know, just provide me with some objective information to establish that. I think that that's reasonable. And even that, even in like San Francisco, you can request that sort of information. But certainly if you're in a jurisdiction that's not limiting evictions for non-payment of rent, you know, you call the shots and then you can prepare the agreement and structure it, you know, how generally how you would like.
Okay, great. I think that covers the questions. I know we had a lot of other questions come in, but I think you all both addressed it just so well that most of them have already been answered. That being said, in conclusion, just want to remind you all that we will have a follow-up with more information, with updates. We know this is a day-by-day situation, and so we definitely want to keep everyone as informed as possible. I think that's the main takeaway here is there is a lot of things that are changing, mm-hmm. and the most important thing that we can do is to be prepared as possible, and really it's a day-by-day learning and also just educating yourself. So that being said, thank you, Brad and Steve, so very much for providing some clarity for our audience. I'm very excited to share this with everybody because I know that they are all a little stressed out about this, maybe a lot stressed out. So appreciate it. And thank you again.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thank you. Just don't forget to text, I think it was YesBC to 474747. That's yes, B as in boy, C as in cat, to 474747 if you want to speak with either Steve or myself. Everyone, thank you and stay safe out there.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you.